Hi, this is Bennett Kelly. Thanks for listening to Cyber Law and Business Report. Before you take a recess to hear the latest internet law news and commentary, you are hereby ordered to download the WebmasterRadio.fm mobile app for iPhone and Android. Okay, maybe not ordered, but why not? You can listen live to my show and all our show hosts every day on our live stream or download past episodes with ease. So download the WebmasterRadio.fm mobile app in the iTunes Store or in the Google Play Store. It's an open and shut case.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly from the Internet Law Center. Please be seated. We have another chilly day here in Santa Monica, but chilly to us is probably quite warm for you. But any event, today is a historic day as the White House has announced some sweeping measures on gun control, but it also is a significant day in history anyway. Roman Empire began today with the when the Senate granted Caesar the title of Augustus from the Roman Senate. And but more specifically, in more recent memory, it is the beginning of the Gulf War. It is the day the Shah of Iran left. So we are today on this auspicious day. We're going to be talking about something that happened very recently, the tragic death of Aaron Swartz. And we have California lawyer Matt Necco to talk about that. And in the second half hour, we're going to be talking about the upcoming festivities in Washington. There's a big shindig going on next week, and it's called the inaugural. And if you're unacquainted with it, we're going to talk about that and give you a little background and maybe how you might want to enjoy it if you still have the chance to get to Washington. So we're going to be back. We're going to cover that in the second half hour. But first, we have Matt Necco. Matt, are you with us?
I'm here, Bennett. Thank you.
And Matt is joining us. Matt's been working in the house with a number of companies and has been very active in intellectual property issues. And so we're glad to have him. Matt, just so everyone's clear, the views expressed here are the views of their participants only, don't reflect anything of their employers or clients, and may not even reflect their views. In addition, it does not constitute legal advice. And if you continue to think about this after 4 hours, please consult a doctor. So, Matt.
I love the double disclaimer at the top of the show and your disclaimer and maybe even mine, which is partly that, none of this could be held against me. My thinking is evolving. Some of what I'm going to, that we're going to discuss, I think, is evolving and maybe thought provocative, but not shouldn't be held against me, at least in any way.
All right, that being understood, it's a pleasure to have you back on again, Matt, and always a pleasure to. We've done a number of panels together in the past, and so basically, for those of you familiar with Aaron Swartz, he committed suicide on Friday and several months before his 27th birthday. By the time he was a mere teenager, he had already been part of the group that had set the protocols for the initial RSS specifications. He was one of the co-owners of Reddit, founder of Creative Commons and Demand Progress. And he's just been a force in the internet during his life, but unfortunately, ran afoul of the law in a way that has sparked the debate.
Yeah, he had quite a background, and while I'm glad to be on the show
to stay in it with you. I'm sorry that it's around a tragic occurrence and topic. And so with that in bearing that in mind, it's really sad that this young man, who I didn't personally know, but who I've only read about and who I benefited from in many ways, it appears, based upon the things that I've read about him. He's done a tremendous amount to advance technology and has been very socially and politically involved in quite a few causes that are important and significant, not the least of which you just mentioned RSS, a really simple syndication, which is a fantastic tool that is utilized widely to help people keep up with automatically keep up with updates to websites and podcasts and all those sorts of things. So
it's interesting. One of the statements about his death was Tim Berners-Lee, who is considered one of the founders of the internet, and simply a tweet that says, "Aaron dead wanders. We have lost a wise elder. Hackers for right. We are one parents. All we have lost a child. Let's weep." So when one of the internet elders refers to a 26-year-old young man as an elder himself, that's quite legion.
Yeah, well, I think that he probably was wise beyond his years in many ways, and I don't want to give short shrift either to the fact that obviously any time that anyone takes their own life or considers taking their own life, that in and of itself is a really tragic thing. And there are so many issues. Sometimes brilliant geniuses have other issues that affect them more deeply in certain ways than it does others, but I'm not a mental health expert by any means.
And let's be clear, and there's a lot of debate going on, and there is one thing being left out. I mean, Aaron had depression, and that was something he battled with. And so what we're really going to talk about is what may have been a major contributing factor in his death, but the fact that he had this disease that he maybe didn't treat well or somehow there was another contributing factor, can't be ignored. And a lot of people have said after we finish the debate on copyright, we also need to talk about the role of depression in technology as well, and especially its isolating effect. So, but let's jump into really what got us here. So Aaron was very much a believer of having free access to information, particularly publicly supported information, and creating a greater public knowledge.
Absolutely, and one of the things that we should sort of make clear here is that the as we talk more about this, the crimes that Aaron was accused of and was indicted for but not convicted, because there had not yet been a trial, involved information in the really the true sense of the word information. A lot of people in the internet world copy left folks, oftentimes use the word information very loosely, and sometimes they lump within that entertainment, movies,
right,
records, television shows. And we're not talking about that kind of information. We're talking about, in this instance at least, academic information. And in the past, he's been involved in attempting to not necessarily liberate information, not necessarily make information free in terms of there not being certain costs associated with it, but sort of helping to create a publicly accessible world library, and was focusing a good amount of his attention on the types of information or documents that taxpayers, in effect, had paid for. And so a lot of his thinking apparently was, well, if taxpayers have already paid for it once, it should be available and free and freely accessible to all of them and everyone, so that the knowledge base can expand and people could do research and have access to these types of information sources.
And one of the first places he did this was in a system that us lawyers are very familiar with, but the public probably is not, called PACER.
And that's right.
All the federal court systems, well, most of the federal court systems, are online, and you can get access to most of the filings. But there's a charge for these public records. And they charge 8 cents per page, more or less. And it actually is quite a moneymaker for the court system. According to one report, it generates a surplus in the hundreds of millions. So yeah, and he actually downloaded 20% of the records, but he couldn't be charged because there was no copyright infringement, because there's no copyright in government documents.
Well, it's very interesting. First of all, in a world of acronyms, PACER stands for Public Access to Court Electronic Records. So it's PACER.
Right, two words on public access.
Right, the public access portion. And it is public access. It just will cost people a little bit more money. What's interesting is that any person can walk into any federal court in the United States, go to the clerk's office, and request to see the file in a court case, and actually get the hard copy of the court file, except in the instances where it's either archived or the file is in the chambers of the judge, because the court is considering a particular case right then and around that period of time. But you can generally take a look at that. And it is true, and there's some controversy over part of this, but it is court opinions, what's written by the judge in each case, is a public document, and that there is no copyright in those documents. I will say that although I don't take this position, although I reserve the right to take this position in the future, there are some who say that briefs written by lawyers might have an element of copyright to them, that perhaps it's a thin copyright, but that there may be some originality and creativity that goes into the writing of a brief by a lawyer. And some take the position that simply because a lawyer has filed that brief with the court, that doesn't mean that that brief is free for everyone to copy. That's sort of a side note. My belief on that is that, generally speaking, most briefs don't have that much creativity to them. It's a lot of and I've read a lot of briefs. They're very dry, most of them, and they have they're mostly factual recitations, and facts cannot be copywritten. There's no copyright in recitation of facts, but there is the ability to have some copyright. So there is, I won't say that it's entirely 100% clear that all of the documents available on PACER are freely available, but there certainly are theories that lawyers who file briefs are sort of waiving their rights to claim copyright, that there's, there are all sorts of other arguments, but in any event.
So yeah, but he made that publicly available. He made 20% of the database public, wasn't charged.
That's right.
So the next strike, though, is what got him in trouble, and that is that on a similar database, except with people just a slightly less exciting than lawyers, and that's academics.
And I don't know.
We'll take a reader survey.
I've been in many classrooms, and I've been in many courtrooms, and I've heard both professors speak and lawyers speak. And I'd say that most of the time, professors are more entertaining than lawyers in court.
A fair assessment. Any event, there's a PACER-like system for academic research called JSTOR, and he used. He has, as a faculty member at Harvard, which is amazing, a 26-year-old kid faculty member at Harvard, he used his access. He had access to MIT, and he was able to download, millions of academic papers.
Yeah, and by the way, there's another acronym, JSTOR. I think that stands for Journal Storage. And so it's for academic journals, primarily academic and scientific journals. I don't know that he gained access to JSTOR's database by virtue of his being a faculty member at Harvard. I think that from what I've read, MIT has a pretty open campus, and anybody can go onto the campus and that they have an open network. So so anyone could go onto the campus and utilize the open wireless internet network to gain access to things like JSTOR.
And so we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Matt's going to tell us what exactly happened with JSTOR and what's the big why there's been a big outcry as a result. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report. At brief recess for our sponsors.
Aim Clear. Bit Social.
Have you tried to do CPA conversions using social PPC and failed? You're not alone. These days, links for their true spec dominate.
Aim Clear. The agency
brings definitive psychographic targeting,
bleeding edge creative,
and killer content amplification advertising table.
Aim Clear. This is how you sell with social. Aim Clear. This is how you sell with social.
Send web indexes. Take a bow to the largest link map in the world. Majestic SEO. Majestic SEO wields its virtual sword with speed and accuracy to deliver detailed reports of your company's link data and that of your competition. Let Majestic SEO make you your own king of internet marketers and join the crusade of clients and agencies that have chosen the noble choice for link intelligence. MajesticSEO.com. Maximize ROI to use your Majestic wield its mighty sword. MajesticSEO.com. It's good to be king.
Time for happy.
You're already done for the day?
Yeah, because I use CertifiedKnowledge.org. Their PPC tools literally save me hours every day.
How do you keep on top of all of Google's new features?
Easy. With Certified Knowledge, their interactive learning modules keep me up to date. And if there's something I don't know, I can watch their video lessons without having to hunt around the Google help files.
Great. I'm ready to expand my knowledge.
Hi, I'm Brett Geddes. I'm the only leader officially supported by Google to teach the advanced track of the AdWords Seminars for Success. I personally recommend CertifiedKnowledge.org as your one stop for all your PPC needs.
Learn, optimize, connect. Be smart. Go to CertifiedKnowledge.org now.
Webmaster, keep Sandy and the feed loaded. We never stop. Do you?
Legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
This is Ben and Kelly. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report, and we're with Matt Necco, and we're talking about Aaron Swartz and his legal battle over JSTOR downloads. So Matt,
Bennett,
we were talking and you were explaining how he got access and he downloaded several million academic articles, which you know, I'm sure is what most 26-year-olds do. And and so he set up a tripwire and more or less got caught in the process, it appears.
Yeah, you know, he did. He got caught because he, you know, the news stories about this are all over the place. But he went into a janitor's closet and had his computer in there, and it was detected eventually, and he got caught. And you know, he was basically there are three parties, four parties when you count Aaron, but. Four parties involved here: Aaron, JSTOR, MIT, and the United States government. And MIT decided that it wasn't going to pursue any charges or ask the local jurisdictional authorities to pursue anything involving trespassing. And But MIT did decide that it was going to at least cooperate and assist the federal government in its investigation. JSTOR initially had some thoughts about whether it was going to pursue any charges, civil charges, against Aaron for apparently, you know, it wasn't hacking, but perhaps violating its terms of service, and decided not to proceed. And the federal government, however, apparently decided that it was going to utilize the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, a law that was passed many years ago, to indict Aaron. And what it basically did is say, you know, the CFAA is drafted in such a way that it can be interpreted that if you violate a website's terms of service or end user license agreement, that constitutes a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which it seems to me and to many to be a stretch, not really what the law was intended to provide for. But the prosecutor took that and said, all right, we're going to indict you. And we've got 12 charges, and each charge carries a term of, I think, 5 years. And so we've got all of that. And Aaron, you're going to have to serve a little bit of jail time here, and let's talk about that.
And so he never distributed the material. There's no measurable. JSTOR is saying bygones. There's no measurable harm to anyone, and he's facing more jail time than someone who commits slavery, for assaulting a member of Congress, for even murder. And actually, if he had stolen the servers, he would have gotten offered less jail time.
Yeah, it seems disproportional. And you know, this, it's look part of what Aaron apparently was doing and has done in the past with Pacer. And by the way, many of those documents that we were talking about, I just want to put a plug in a way for public access to those public documents. People can, in fact, go online and get those documents, some of those documents, for free, because the Internet Archive has them available. I think it's at recap.archive.org. And there's also a Firefox extension that Aaron helped to develop, that if someone pays for and downloads a document from Pacer, that mm-hmm. document automatically gets uploaded to some servers. And then when somebody else is searching, has this Firefox extension and is searching for the documents sees that it's already been downloaded and is available on a server and can get it for free. So there's just wanted to tell people about that.
And but, so, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, part of what happens in a society where the law perhaps moves more slowly than technology, and where law moves more slowly than societal changes itself, is a concept of civil disobedience. And, you know, there have been many philosophers and social people involved in social movements who have been involved in civil disobedience. And they are exposing themselves to the possibility of being charged with crimes because the crimes don't keep up with society and what's changing in society. And it's interesting that we're coming up on a pretty significant holiday on Monday, Martin Luther King Day. You know, Martin Luther King probably engaged in some civil disobedience. People who protested against things that were wrong at the time engaged in certain amounts of civil disobedience. So, you know, you even take things like file sharing and look at how many people have downloaded music, for example. And I'm not saying that it's right, but sometimes if there's a mass movement of people engaging in some certain activities that at the time are illegal, perhaps, and exposing themselves to being charged with crimes, they may be engaging in civil disobedience, and the laws, in fact, may change as a result of social movements saying the norm is different. And so perhaps what Aaron was doing to a certain extent was engaging in a bit of social and civil disobedience, where he said, okay, these things should be free. These academic papers and documents should be free. They're not, so I'm going to do something to help to make them free. And so, you know, I don't know that he really took into account the possibility that he would be charged with a crime. I certainly don't think that he took into account the possibility that there would be that the prosecutor, the attorney for the federal government, would take a strong stance and a position and say to him, you know, you can potentially get 35 years, but let's negotiate perhaps we'll bargain for a plea. And if you plead guilty, then I'll only request 7 years. And recently they said, it's been reported that they went down to 6 months. Question is, you know, even 6 months, is that excessive? And when you take into account the aspects of the civil disobedience, when you take into account the possibility, the very real possibility that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act really was not intended to punish people for the types of activities that Aaron engaged in, then he probably was somewhat excessive for the prosecutor to take that position. And I don't know that it would really have that great of a deterrent effect on others in the future from engaging in this kind of civil disobedience. And so it's not a clear cut issue. It's a difficult issue, but I'm talking a lot, Bennett. Any thoughts?
No, I mean, I hear you. I think the operative word is really proportionality, and there was something that was said quite eloquently by a number of his friends in commenting on his passing, and I'm struck by what Lawrence Lessig said, and the person he said, driven to the edge, but what a decent society would only call bullying, and he explained, I get wrong, but I also get proportionality. And if you don't get both, you don't deserve to have the power of the United States government behind you. And that's the issue here was, granted, the whole idea of civil disobedience is, yes, there is a risk you'll be arrested. But no one expects that person who's going to be arrested to be sent away for 30 years, you know, for a lunch counter demonstration, say, for example. Yes, Martin Luther King went to jail, but I don't think he was ever at risk of being in jail for 40 years. Or if it was, you know, the law would certainly have intervened from the federal level, at least. And so that's what we see, and we're seeing this happening at a time when we're seeing other instances where we have we had on our show last year, you know, a college student who downloads 13 songs and now must pay $1 million in fines and attorney's fees, and it's just an excessiveness and applied to something that really isn't advancing a societal goal.
Yeah, it's right. It is advancing societal goals. That's not to say that JSTOR itself doesn't have costs. Certainly it has costs. It has server costs. It has costs in collecting the data and everything like that. And so not everything is free. And but once JSTOR so part of the thinking here should be if there is federally funded research or taxpayer paid for research, then there should be some easier access to those documents, and perhaps they should be made available for free at some point. And server costs can be de minimis or nothing when you think about using, for example, peer-to-peer file sharing software, which, by the way, the BitTorrent protocol and peer-to-peer file sharing software is a fantastic means of distributing the costs of making available these types of things. And so it's not just entertainment, it's information. And, you know, we're in the age of data crunching, big data. So maybe if all of those articles were available and some researcher said, okay, now that all of those articles are available, or even some kid who is not a researcher and doesn't have access to a university and JSTOR could take all of those documents and say, okay, I'm going to develop an algorithm to try to do some research here on, you know, whatever it may be, all the papers on a particular topic to come up with something more. I mean, there's so much that could be done with this information, and not the least of which, of course, is the average citizen who has an interest in reading an academic paper, perhaps on a medical subject that they don't know about. You know, whether it's something like you know, the ketogenic diet for epilepsy and how to help to cure that, and making people more aware of something like that. That's hugely important.
No, I agree, and. That was one of the important things that he did, was in trying to expand access. And, you know, say you are someone who's afflicted by some, you know, unique ailment, and getting access to that information is helpful. I mean, granted, JSTOR does allow a certain limited amount of free access to its work. But, I mean, the point here, though, is that we have a very heavy-handed tactics being applied over knowledge, copyright, and you have what we've seen is that all the sites being taken down, sometimes unjustifiably so. And is this what the government should be doing, or is and particularly since, you know, we've expanded the right of copyright so long, you know, went from the original 14 years to now the life and beyond, that it's become an oppressive tool and not a means of expanding knowledge and creativity.
No, it's true. And, you know, it is a question of proportionality. And it is a question of our laws being reexamined on a fairly regular basis. And, look, you know, the current administration, the Obama administration, hasn't necessarily been as advanced as many would like in terms of technology and free information, and has focused quite a bit on attempting to protect the homeland against threats of terrorism. And so they look a lot
at what's going on in cyberspace and the internet, I think, with that in mind. And so there has to be some amount of balance when we're looking at these kinds of crimes, if they are crimes, and reforming the law more quickly than we do, which of course requires politicians in Washington and in state capitals to not be quite so partisan, and to act more quickly, and to make changes to the law when it's important and necessary, and as society develops and as technology develops.
I agree entirely, and I don't know if we can count too far on the act less partisan, but it is important that we try to figure out what we're going to do here. And what'll be interesting is the next time Bambi or whatever the oldest Walt Disney character comes up and starts bumping up against the copyright, whether we extend it even further for whatever Disney needs, and because that would be a good time to have that debate.
Well, I think it's a good time to have the debate now.
I agree too.
And who knows what's going to happen with the next copyright extension reform act that comes up.
Because that's what we've been doing. We keep pushing it back and back, and rather than addressing what is our goal here. Because the original goal was promote advancement of knowledge and science and the arts. And, are we doing that? But we also have to promote our station in a few minutes. But Matt, anything you want to tell us about what you're up to before we have to break?
I'm off to my office to put my head down and work hard for the rest of the day, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some of my my non-expert viewpoints on this matter. And again, I'm stricken by the tragedy here, and I certainly hope for change.
And I would second that thought. Well, thank Matt. It's always a pleasure. Thank you again. Happy New Year. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking about the insider guide to the inaugural after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Building better systems takes the right formula. Tracking those rankings is super simple.
All you need is authoritylabs.com.
Authority Labs uses automated daily rank tracking tools to monitor your site's performance or leverage their API to build your own tools. No matter what animal-labeled algorithms affect your ranking,
you should be using Authority Labs.
Unlimited users for no additional cost and white labeling can help keep your clients updated and save countless hours of creating reports. Whether you're running sites with just a few or millions of keywords,
what you need is authoritylabs.com.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. TopSEOs sends you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let Top SEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
Johnson, what's this mantis I keep hearing about? Do we need to call an exterminator?
No, sir. Moby Mantis is our new SMS marketing tool.
SM what?
SMS. Text messaging. Moby Mantis lets us communicate directly with our customers in real time. We can send promos, coupons. It even lets our customers market for us by sharing offers with their friends online. It's been great for business.
Sounds expensive.
Actually, I signed us up for an extended free trial. It hasn't cost us a dime.
Good work, Johnson. I guess the only thing we'll be exterminating is the competition.
Get your free extended trial of Moby Mantis. Text radio to 21691. That's radio to 21691 for Moby Mantis.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back, and Monday, we'll have the 57th inaugural ceremony in the history of the United States, and it is a relatively rare event. And we have a special guest, a good friend of the show, Patrick Okada, who, Patrick, how should I describe you?
Well, I'm an educator, an administrator, and I'm a Washingtonian.
Patrick is a longtime Washingtonian. You moved to Washington in, what, 1985?
Yes.
So Patrick just missed the coldest inaugural in history, which was in 1984 under President Reagan, and where it got as low as -7. It was so cold they actually had to cancel the outdoor proceedings, and which brings us to why Patrick is on. And on Monday will be the second swearing in and inaugural festivities for President Obama. And so we're going to give you a little preview of what it might be like. And for those of you who have the opportunity to go to Washington during this time period or even wonder what it might be like, we hope this might be of interest to you. We strongly encourage anyone who has the opportunity to go. Regardless of politics, it's a fascinating time to see your nation's capital, and it's a moment in history. And if you think about, you know, some of the great speeches or the great moments in history of our country, we have no fear but fear itself. Well, that was President Roosevelt in his first inaugural address. Ask not what you can do for your country. Again, President Kennedy at his first inaugural address. And so these are events that define our history, and I think to be able to bring your family and to say that you were there is definitely a remarkable thing. So let's start. What's happening now? This is Wednesday, and we're having the inaugural on Monday. And I think this was kind of a similar setup for when Clinton's second inaugural, Patrick. And I think things start picking up in Washington right about now, don't they?
Yes, they start picking up. The inaugural committee, of course, organizes a lot of activities to bring up to speed a lot of the volunteers that will be helping out in all of the various events. And in effect, they put on all the finishing touches for the inaugural festivities.
But also what's going on is there's a whole while you have all the official events that are happening, parallel to it is every organization that has any presence in Washington is also having a function. And so, and some of those are some of the more entertaining functions that you may get to go to. So, for example, there'll be a series of parties between now and Sunday night for those various groups. And I recall going to the Texas Society Ball in 1997, and that was a bipartisan group of Texans with tuxes and cowboy boots and gowns, and it was a real nice spread, and there was all sorts of Texas society there. Naturally, being from Rhode Island, I fit right in. And Patrick, you may recall, we went to, during the Clinton years, one of the early parties was an informal party organized by the Arkansas Society, or I believe they called themselves the Travelers, the Blue Jeans Bash. Do you remember that, Patrick?
Yes, I do. I do remember that very, very well. In fact, we saw Clinton's mother there and the Regent Cajun while we were there, too.
So. Oh, that was a different party, Patrick.
I'm mixing them up now.
Yes. One, we saw Roger Clinton that, and yes. It was just a barbecue and rock and roll and a good time at the Mayflower. But yeah, Patrick, I remember we rushed back from a ski trip, and to see, they had a party honoring James Carville, the
yes.
Raging Agent, and
Clinton, agent, yes.
And it was held, I remember right by where Duke Zebert's used to be, wherever that is. And
it's now Morton's.
It's Morton's. And because of the Carville being from Louisiana and there was a Mardi Gras theme, and so lots of beads. It was a really good party. But I always remember at the end of the night talking to Virginia Kelly, Clinton's mom, who actually spells the last name the same as mine, and introducing myself, saying we had a shared name. And she was just flat out exhausted. I mean, she was a balloon that had the air squeezed out of her, and there was no life in her at that moment. But then all I said was, "You must be so proud." And her face just lit up, and you know, it was the brightest light in the room. And you know, all of a sudden, she was renewed. And I guess it's hard to imagine how proud a mother must feel when their son's being inaugurated. And so, it's just a moment I will always remember. Remember, you know, having seen her, and plus she passed not that long after. But so you have this whole period now, and this is actually for outsiders who are trying, who probably don't have a prayer or anything on an inaugural day. If you're cagey, and if you talk to people, and there are people who have tickets in their pockets to all sorts of things, and you might get a bump into someone and get to go to one of these events. I'm not saying you're going to see James Carville, but you know, that's definitely a fun one you can get to. Now,
I also have a word of advice for those that are coming in from other states to Washington. Your congressmen and senators have lots of tickets to different things, if not the inaugural ceremony, which of course those tickets they guard very, very dearly, but they also are invited to a host of events that either they or their staffers have no time to go to. So it's always a good bet that if you check in with your congressman or senator, you may actually be able to score last minute tickets to some very, very wonderful event.
And actually, here is counterintuitive. Here it is a good thing if your congressman is a Republican, because you know they're not as enthusiastic about these festivities as those on the Democratic side, and you know they're much more inclined to just give those tickets away. So, to the extent that you know someone on that side, that's a good way to actually make it so that you, even at a late hour, may still have a shot of being somewhere on inauguration day that's fun to watch. And so I think the other fun thing about just being in Washington during this period, you know, including the inaugural itself, is the number of people that pour into the city. And I mean pour. I mean, there were over a million people that came in for the Obama inaugural, and it's just the people watching is amazing, both in terms of politicos, but also celebrities. I mean, you see Beyonce, you see all these people, and DC is a compact city. You know, you're gonna see these people, or at least see their limo and see them getting out of the limo. And if you hang out at some of the nicer hotels, you'll be seeing a lot of these people in the lobby. It's kind of a fun time to be there. Cold.
I think it's also a time when you really remember what makes America great. I mean, you are watching democracy in action, yes, but you're also watching a tradition which has spanned hundreds of years. And Washington, D.C. knows how to throw the party for the inauguration because they've been doing it for a long time. So for those that have not really had an opportunity to see it, and even those that have seen it once or twice, it still is a fun event to go and witness. Even if you don't get into any of the shows or events, you have the parade. And all you just need to do is get a good spot on Pennsylvania Avenue between the Capitol building and the White House, and you are guaranteed to see a lot of the of those leaving the ceremony on Capitol Hill and going towards the White House, including the president.
Now let's jump to that. And actually, before we do, I just got a note from a listener who attended attended last time, but will not be able to attend this year. Seema Kalia, thank you for your note. But she did make a good point, and I don't know if the president will get a chance to address this, but she does think that she should automatically get tickets because Monday is her birthday. I don't know if that angle, how well that's been played, but any event, Seema, good luck with that. I'm sure you'll be watching on TV with me and everyone else. But in any event, Patrick, so you were very good at getting people yourself positioned for the parade. How'd you do that? Where were you last time?
Well, I mean, the thing is to read a little bit about the parade itself and what happens. It has become a tradition now that once the president gets to the corner of Pennsylvania and 15th Street, he normally gets out of his limo and walks the rest of the way with the first lady. And
right.
So all you just need to do is position yourself somewhere around the 15th and Pennsylvania and the White House. That last part of the route, and you're guaranteed to see if past inaugurals or anything to go by. You're guaranteed to see the president and first lady returning from the Capitol Hill.
And you know, it's a harder thing to achieve, but some of those restaurants in that spot, you know, Old Ebbitt Grill being one of them, actually do have parties going on. And I've been fortunate. You know, I've watched it twice from the Old Ebbitt, which is nice because you're warm, operative word, warm. And you do get to see them because that's often right where they get out. And so what other tips, Patrick, do you have for an inaugural newbie?
Well, I think even if you are not able to get tickets to the official inaugural balls, there are so many unofficial balls that will still give you the same experience because people will be well dressed up for those balls. And once in a while, Congress people, even cabinet officials do stop into those balls even though they are unofficial. So it still gives you the experience of having attended an inaugural ball.
Now, Patrick, you've attended both.
Both official and unofficial, yes. And that's why I'm speaking from experience. Once you are inside, atmosphere is almost the same. The only difference is that the president and the vice president wouldn't go to the unofficial ones. They will only attend official balls.
It still is a celebratory atmosphere. You're right. And I do recall that. And we went to the Jersey Ball one year. That was that was colorful. And
last inaugural, we went to the DC Ball, which was not an official ball. And we still had a wonderful time.
Now tell you, were you dancing next to Madeleine Albright at the Clinton second ball?
That was the Clinton second ball. I was dancing, actually at some point, dancing with Madeleine Albright and I'm having a good time. And this was when she was the ambassador to the United Nations before then becoming Secretary of State.
I do recall dancing and I remember one of the performers was Meatloaf, and he sang 2 out of 3 ain't bad. And here I am in the tux, looking over. And I remember looking at Madeleine Albright and thinking, "This is something very bizarre. I'm dancing to this high school song I grew up with, and being sung live by Meatloaf." It was just a strange visual image that still, I don't know if this disturbs me or stays with me. But then, if you're really lucky, after the balls comes the after ball. And if you can pull that off, that is a fun ticket to get because all the balls end at midnight, but this one goes from midnight to 2 or 3 o'clock. Oh, looks like we lost Patrick. Oh, this is disappointing. But any event, if you can make the after ball, it's a lot of fun. And it's the hardest ticket of all to get next to actually getting seats at the inaugural ceremony itself. But so if you're So if you're sitting at home or listening and haven't decided whether you want to go to Washington, it's a great time to be there. It's going to be cold as hell. I'll give you that. And that's just not me as a Californian. It's cold. I mean, and the temperature prediction is cold. But D.C. is very tourist friendly. There's many ways to get there. You can drive. There's tons of airports that are within, you know, a 2-hour drive of the city. And it's history. I mean, if you want your child or you want to see history up front and personal and then see a whole cross century of your country coming together for one huge shindig, this is it. It's a fun time. And you can even get better benefit of it. Go to Georgetown and go to the sports bars and watch the NFL, because there'll be a lot of controversy over the Patriots and the Ravens, and I'm sure the Ravens fans in that area will be disappointed after the Patriots win. And so it's a great time. If you can make it, do it. But certainly be sure to watch history as it unfolds on Monday on TV if you can't. But in any event, I want to thank Patrick for being able to join us. I know he was calling us from overseas on his business travel, so I'm sorry he wasn't able to finish with us. But in any event, it's history, and D.C. does it right. And if you ever get a chance, whether it's this inaugural or a future inaugural when Brasco becomes president, you know, you definitely want to be there. So that's all we have on the inaugural. I hope this was an insightful and a little visit to, in very short terms, of the inaugural process. And I hope you'll consider going at some point. And I still have fond memories of my experiences during inaugurals. And even through the cold, it's still worth it. So, and that's traveling from California to Washington. And I would do it in a heartbeat if I wasn't so busy. So I hope you'll consider it as well. This is Cyber Law and Business Report from Santa Monica, California, in the warm heart of Silicon Beach. This is Bennett Kelly. Goodbye, and we'll talk to you next week. Court's adjourned.
This has been a presentation of WebmasterRadio.fm, the world's largest business-to-business radio and podcast network. We welcome you to sample past episodes of this program, as well as our complete library of programs, on demand or on the air via our 24/7 live audio stream at www.webmasterradio.fm. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.